You are listening to Rise Up Radio on WBAI 99.5 FM and streaming live at WBAI.org. We're joined here by Sharda Sekharan of the Center for Economic and Social Rights, Alan, Liz, and Chino from the Justice for Youth Coalition, and Mike Eskenazi of the National Center for Schools and Communities at Fordham University.
Mike, your organization just released a report called Equity or Exclusion, the Dynamics of Resources, Demographics, and Behavior in the New York City Public Schools. That report draws connections between access to resources and student behavior. Do you think you could talk a little bit about the findings of the report and how those findings relate to the new police and schools policy and what we were just talking about, education as a human right?
Sure. And listening to Chino, it seems that the students might know better than politicians and the school administrators what students need. I mean, she was saying that schools, students prefer to have better resources and fewer police in the schools. Well, we did a study where we looked at 3 years of data from the New York City schools, and we looked at connections between resources and the way students behave. And we saw that schools that have better teachers, more qualified teachers, smaller schools, better library resources, newer computers, all these things factor into student behavior. You get better attendance, you get fewer suspensions. All those student behaviors are improved at better schools. And this is true across race and class lines. So if there's a school that's, say, 100% white, two schools that are 100% white, and one has less qualified teachers and one has older textbooks, you know, one just has poorer resources, you can expect that school to have lower attendance, more suspension, bigger dropout rates, and all sorts of problems. But with that, with the fact that these things hold true across race lines, race and class lines, is the fact that these resources aren't distributed equitably. So you get schools that have large high poverty populations and large populations of Black and Latino students, those schools tend to get the lesser resources. So we're sort of setting them up to fail. We're talking today about the 12 schools that the mayor put on the list of to target with new police officers. 10 of those schools are high schools. In our study, we looked at school size. We found that 1,500 students is a sort of threshold with student behavior in schools. If schools that have over 1,500 students, suspension rates start to go up, dropout rates start to go up. The 10 high schools on that list of 12 schools average almost 3,000 students per school. So, I mean, the first obvious thing to look at is, you know, what's going on in these schools? How big are these schools? If you provide different schools, if you broke it up to smaller schools with smaller classrooms, you could expect these things to start to go down. I mean, when there's overcrowding at schools, students rub together, there's going to be more friction. It's just a more tense environment.
Adelaide Stevenson High School, the school where we spoke with students earlier this week, has a poverty rate of 75% and 3,600 students in it. I mean, it's no surprise that this is a community that's not getting resources and where people are having trouble in their schools.
And, you know, as I was saying, I think Chino's onto something about, I mean, she's saying how students would prefer to have newer textbooks and fewer police officers, but that also might be an effective way to reduce, you know, violence in schools. I like to give there's a group we work with at the National Center of Schools and Communities called Community Advocates for Education Excellence in Washington Heights. Now, they're one of the few groups in the city that advocates for students involved in disciplinary procedures because students often don't know their rights when they're suspended and can be out of school for a week or two and not know that they have a right to a fair hearing. Well, Community Advocates for Education Excellence represented a student about 2 years ago at George Washington High School in Washington Heights, where he was a new student in school. He transferred in around November, and he was caught with he had a nail clipper on his keychain that when it went through the metal detector, they said that the blade on it was too big. It was like an inch and a quarter blade, and he was suspended. He was out of school for over a week. He wasn't in any school. He wasn't in any suspension center. He just missed a week of school until finally the advocates got the case just thrown out. In the meantime, the kid missed over a week of school, the new school, where it was tense enough anyway. All right, so he goes back to school. 2 weeks later, somebody snuck into school before it started, came in through a back door, planted a gun in a stairwell, came in and shot two students. So, I mean, is that an effective way to... as everyone was saying, I mean, if it's a big enough school with enough doors, people are going to get weapons in. If you could break up the school and give more intense support to students, you're not going to have as many problems. But if we just throw more police at the problems, we're going to have violations like this where this kid who did nothing wrong missed a week of school. I mean, you're just putting a kid out of school. It's not a solution.
You mentioned briefly the suspension centers, Chino or Liz or Alan. Do one of you guys want to talk about these new suspension centers and their connection to the sort of empty beds in the juvenile detention centers that we see around the city, whether you see there being a connection between those two things?
Yeah, so these suspension centers are just basically places to ship kids off when they're suspended. So, and you know, I don't think there's a real, like, agenda about learning behind these suspension centers. The agenda is about, well, we don't want them on the street, so we're going to put them somewhere. And as far as, like, with the connection with the jail beds, I mean, the Justice for Youth Coalition successfully pulled $53 million out of a $64.6 million budget last year, and it was $65 million proposed for the expansion of two juvenile detention facilities by 100 beds each. And this came at a time where the city had cut the Board of Ed budget by $450 million. The way we got this money pulled out of the budget and we stopped the expansion because the Department of Juvenile Justice could not prove that they needed these beds. All three facilities, which is Spofford, a.k.a. Bridges, Crossroads, and Horizons, were under capacity at the time, about 70 to 75% capacity at the time that they wanted to expand. And then the only excuse that they had is that they projected that youth crime would go up. So the Mayor Bloomberg, you know, being a coward that he is, left it up to the Department of Juvenile Justice to take the money out of the budget. So they couldn't really, you know, they came under a lot of fire from the city council, you know, folks like Charles Barron, James E. Davis when he was alive and stuff, Yvette Clark, you know, really, you know, stuck it to the Department of Juvenile Justice, and they couldn't prove that they didn't need this money, so they pulled it out the money. Now, what's pulled it out the budget? So what's interesting about that is that even though that money was pulled out the budget, does not mean at any given time they could put that money back into the budget. Justice for Youth Coalition is also trying to make the city keep its promise that it made to the folks up in the Bronx and by where Spofford is that they would close Spofford and turn it into community center. And what they did is that they closed Spofford for a month or two and built two new facilities, Crossroads, which is in Brownsville, Brooklyn, and Horizons, which is in the Bronx, but actually reopened Spofford under the name Bridges at a cost of like $8 to $9 million and use it as an intake center. So what happens is if a 13-year-old gets arrested in Brooklyn, he has to be shipped all the way up to Spofford, intake, and then back down to Brooklyn to be housed. So effectively, that this young person can be lost in the system, and the parents or the guardians will have more trouble of finding them. Now, both of these two new facilities are state of the art. There's no reason that these facilities could not do intake where they're at. Not only would it speed up the process of intake and will also cut the rate of the child being lost in the system, but it also would decrease the number of beds within New York City for juvenile offenders. So, I mean, you know, if you trivialize, right, if you make everything a crime with a young person, even normal adolescent behavior, what's going to happen? The juvenile arrest rates are going to go up. So what is the Department of Juvenile Justice going to say? Oh, wow, who knew? We actually need that $64.6 million for the expansion because they're being because there's so many juvenile arrests. Mm. So if you ask me, this is a ploy by the Department of Juvenile Justice and the mayor to, like, basically, you know, hoodwink the New York City population and its youth and just lock us up.
Can I just say something about the suspension centers, too? I mean, they tend to be a joke because under state law, every student up to, I think, 21 years old is entitled to a public education. And if you're up to 18 years old, the schools have a responsibility to put you in a facility where you're going to get the same education that you would get in your regular school. So if you're suspended, you're supposed to get the same enrichment and everything. Suspension centers tend to be one room with one teacher teaching all grades of kids. And traditionally, they don't monitor who goes there. So if someone's suspended, they can just be out of school. I mean, you're pushing someone out of school completely where they're not getting any education. It came up this year. This has been a big issue because a few of the suspension centers closed down, and principals wanted to send their students to suspension centers and found there was nowhere to send them, so they put them back in the classrooms. And it seems that these principals weren't aware that normally when you send a kid to a suspension center, they don't necessarily go. So, I mean, it's interesting that it came to a head that way. But something else I want to point out about the ineffectiveness of suspension centers, this year there was a new suspension center at Taft High School in the Bronx, which is one of the big schools on the list. And a problem came up in November right after it opened, which was that three students who were in a fight together at a different Bronx high school were all sent to the same suspension center. And they were in one classroom for 60 kids with one teacher. And, of course, they started to fight again. And, I mean, just the whole thing's a sham. It's are these kids really getting the same education they would get if they were in school and not in a suspension center?
I don't even think you need to ask that as a question. I think the answer is no. This is Rise Up Radio on WBAI, and we're speaking with – that was Mike Eskenazi from the National Center for Schools and Communities. We have Sharda Sekaran from the Center for Economic and Social Rights, and Alan Holder, Liz Clarissier, and Chino Hardin of the Justice for Youth Coalition.
My question right now is that we've been talking about suspension centers, and they clearly don't work, and they seem to actually be harming students more than anything. But how do you deal with students who are being violent or who are creating problems with other students who are hurting education? Maybe, Alan, you want to answer that? Or?
Well, I do believe that students are acting violent due to circumstances, probably with family, or they have problems on their block and so on and so forth. And being that you're coming to school with police officers have guns and they like to search you through metal detectors, throw kids on the wall and whatnot, it's putting more pressure onto their feelings that they already have built up inside, and they're not enough counselors that they can talk to. So they're just holding all this anger and acting out on the people that they're not supposed to. But I guess it comes out one way or another. And I do believe if teachers see that a child has a problem, they should at least give him the full amount of attention to know that he needs a counselor, somebody to talk to. And if it goes on like that, most of the kids should have counselors, and I believe that there will be less violence in the schools because they will have somewhere to direct or channel their anger that they have.
Sharda Sekaran, did you want to jump in before?
Yeah, I just wanted to go back to international human rights law and what young people are entitled to, you know, the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, the World Declaration on Education for All. Basically what they lay out are basic standards that the government is supposed to ensure for young people. It's supposed to create an environment, a learning environment that allows young people to develop, every young person to develop to their fullest potential. And when it comes down to discipline, the environment should be focused on nonviolence. So that's supposed to be, the environment is supposed to be nonviolent. It's supposed to give children dignity. It's supposed to encourage each one of them. I mean, this seems like so radical to us because our system has deviated so much from these principles, but we really have rights to every young person being given the resources and an environment that allows them to develop to their full potential. And when there is a response to violence in schools, it has to be done with the dignity of the child in mind. It cannot be done in a way that violates their human rights, and it must be done in a way that focuses on nonviolence. And these are things, these are conventions and standards that are supposed to be what we use as a platform to build our policy. Like, these are the outcomes that we're looking for. An outcome is a healthy learning environment. An outcome is each child being able to have access to resources that they need to be able to grow and to develop. And each child being protected from discrimination, which is another key point that Chino was bringing up during the break, which is that the system functions in a way that's really discriminatory. I mean, it's not a coincidence that the lowest performing schools, the schools where the focus is on coercion and on punishment instead of on thinking about intervention in a nonviolent way, on conflict mediation, are the schools where they're primarily Black and Latino students. 97% of the students in the lowest performing schools are Black or Latino. And that's a human rights violation, the inequitable distribution of resources, the really discriminatory response. Like, young people have protections and rights that are supposed to be ensured by the state, and these policies completely lose sight of that. And they also don't inform themselves from the larger criminal justice system, which we've seen, like, focusing on coercion, focusing on punishment, thinking that you can lock yourself up into a healthier society doesn't work in the bigger picture. Why they think that this really failed experiment, being tough on crime and trying to incarcerate your way out of social problems, you know, is not the road to justice. It's a road to greater inequities and greater human rights violations.
And because of this, like, you know what I mean, because of the human rights violation, these kids right now being subjected to the hiring of more cops in school, they're not coming to school because of the fear they may be criminalized and subjected to an arrest for a minor violation of not bringing ID to school, having a cut-up shirt on, or just swarming the halls. They're being arrested for things that they should not be arrested for. Because if you look at it from my end, these overcrowded, poorly funded schools equals high illiteracy rates, high rates of people dropping out from school, high rates of incarceration. People don't see that connection, that school-to-prison pipeline right there. They're extracting all these resources, all these programs from these worst-performing schools, so these kids have nothing but time on their hands. If you give them something to do with their loose time, I guarantee you they will not be swarming the halls or doing violent supposed acts or being criminalized for everything they do.
Can I just say that, you know, wordless, and Sharda, you're definitely absolutely right. Let's look at Columbine. Let's look at white suburbia. Let's look at what all the most atrocious acts of violence between young people has happened in white suburbia. And what do? Did they run out and buy, go to Target and get all the metal detectors they could find? Did they hire a task force of police officers to swarm the halls and criminalize young people? No. They took the proactive measure. They put programs in these schools. They put counselors in these schools. Now, these are the schools in suburbia that has been having crazy violence between young people. Not just one kid killing a kid. I'm talking about they would shoot up the whole school. And they still don't have metal detectors in there. They still don't have police and armed guards in there. They still are not criminalizing their young people because they learned early on from the gate that criminalizing and punishment does not work with young people. Young people are rebellious and they're going to rebel no matter. That's just the nature of a child, you know? And if you put cops and metal detectors and armed guards in a school, what does it become? It becomes a prison. Now tell me what happens in prison. Violence. So why are we surprised?
If I can add something to that, please. Just quickly. I agree with everything Sharda and Gina just said. And I think it's an important question that what do you do with disruptive students? Because, I mean, teaching's a hard job, especially if you've got a big classroom and if they're disruptive students, you've got to do something about it. But unfortunately, this seems to be the only question that we as a city are asking is what are we going to do with the disruptive students and not what can we do ahead of time to give them something to do. As Sharda was saying, there are no resources in these schools for these kids to do anything constructive. I mean, the whole emphasis was in recent months has been on the fact that the city closed down 4 suspension centers. Is anyone talking about the fact that there are dozens of high schools in the city with no libraries, no auditoriums, no functioning gymnasiums? I mean, that's really egregious.
What Bloomberg is trying to say is he'd rather invest in a holding cell in that same school than invest in building up that library, putting new books in that library. That's what Bloomberg is saying. He'd rather put a cop next to every student than put a textbook next to every student or even a teacher next to every student.
I think the message is that rather than providing quality schools that kids want to come to and where we can retain students, you know, we're doing things to push students out of school.
Mm-hmm. But the only way that you could provide those schools, though, is if you stop the overcrowding. I mean, there's so many kids in these one school. Right. In one school, there's 3,000 kids. You're bound to find violence. You're bound to find people who don't like one another. And you're bound to find kids who are not getting enough attention from the teachers.
That's why there's no auditorium.
Because there's 35 students in a class with one teacher.
Right.
Not all 35 kids are going to be getting attended to. Some are slower than some, and they're not getting the attention that they need from teachers.
They treat these young people like caged animals, and that's a problem in New York City. That's a problem across the country, but especially in New York City, which is supposed to be the most prominent and most large, you know, really successful city in the country, and we're not. We're like locking up our future and throwing away the key.
We unfortunately are very close to out of time. Sharda, I wanted to just briefly have you in about 1 minute talk. You talked about students having a right to education. Is that an enforceable right? What does that mean that we have a right to be educated?
Well, basically what it means is that under international law, there's the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, which this is really disgraceful, but every country in the world has signed and ratified it except for the United States and Somalia. which is really, really something that we have to hold our leadership accountable to. But what it does create are internationally recognized standards that are relevant because they're nearly universally accepted in almost all the countries in the world. So they do get summoned in the U.S. courts, and they are considered a rational basis, like a realistic basis for judging education policy. And what they require are, they break it down into the four A's, which is that education has to be accessible, which means that it has to be something that people can get access to. It has to be available, which means that the proper resources have to be there to make education available to young people. It has to be acceptable, which means it has to be of good quality, and it has to be adaptable and relevant to what young people are, what their realities are, and culturally and socially appropriate. And instead of doing that, and instead of opening up a broader access to education, we're making it more and more exclusive. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to look at, and I'll just say this in 2 seconds, but this policy coupled with something else that the organization I work for is documenting right now, which is the impact of high-stakes testing. Mm-hmm. When you put those two factors together, mm-hmm. you know, more police in school, excluding mm-hmm. more learners, excluding them either through high-stakes testing or through criminalization, and we're creating an environment that's less accessible, which is a human rights violation.
We unfortunately have to wrap up. This has been a really interesting show, and we're definitely going to be talking about this issue more. Unfortunately, I wish that we could, you know, resolve all this real quick, but it's not going to happen. I mean, Shardy, you were talking about how you've been protesting these same similar issues 12 years ago. Before we go out, can you quickly give the contact information for your respective groups?
Well, the Center for Economic and Social Rights, which is based in Brooklyn, you can look at our website, which is www.cesr.org, or you can call us at 718-237-9145. We have copies of reports that we can send out to people and fact sheets on human rights and education.
You can contact the Justice for Youth Coalition at 718-260-8805 or send us an email at jfy@nomoreprisons.org or just visit our website, either nomoreprisons.org or nomoreyouthjails.org.
And Mike?
The website for the National Center for Schools and Communities is ncsc@fordham.org. And if you go to our homepage, you can download a copy of the study we were talking about, Equity or Exclusion.
And we will post all of that on our website, which is www.riseupradio.org. And I just really quickly want to say, as we're very fast running out of time, that next weekend is the New York City Grassroots Media Conference. Rise Up Radio is going to be doing a training on mini disc recording and reporting for radio. That training is for young people only, and it will be Sunday morning at 10 a.m. You can find out more about that workshop and the whole conference at nycgrassrootsmedia.org. There are a bunch of other announcements that we wanted to try to get to, but we will put them up on our website at riseupradio.org. And today's show was produced by Kat, Leanne, Dorian, Doug, and Naomi. Your hosts today have been Kat, Naomi, and Doug. Our engineer today was Errol Maitland.
And thanks for tuning in. We're out.
Peace.
If you get past my dog, you could steal my whole floor. I got plenty of nothing. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Ain't nothing ain't plenty for me. That's right. I got plenty of nothing. Whoa, whoa, whoa.